From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation for a couple of weeks, and I'll be filling in. On this edition of Fresh Air, I speak with investigative reporter Mark Dowie. He uncovered the dangers of the Dalkon Shield contraceptive in the Ford Pinto automobile. Now he's written a book on the world of organ transplants called We Have a Donor. Also today, we talk with poet and critic Robert Haas. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from flugelhorn player Franz Kogelman. And television critic David Bien Cooley examines the two latest challengers to Johnny Carson, Arsenio Hall and Pat Sajak. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. As recently as 40 years ago, the idea of transferring body parts from one person to another was written off as a rare curiosity by most people in the medical profession. Today, organ and tissue transplants are routine operations. Almost 15,000 vital organs were transplanted in 1987. My guest, investigative reporter Mark Dowie, looks into the world of organ transplanting in his new book, We Have a Donor. Dowie has won several awards for his reporting for Mother Jones magazine. His first article exposed how the contraceptive device, the Dalkon Shield, was put on the market after inadequate testing and was aggressively promoted, even though the company knew of its dangers. Dowie also discovered that the Ford Motor Company put the Pinto into production, while knowing there was a potentially lethal flaw in the gas tank design. Mark Dowie first joined Mother Jones magazine as the business manager. The following year, he was named general manager, and he started researching the article on the Dalkon Shield in his free time.
I was dissatisfied with the quality of investigative reporting that the magazine was doing. When we launched the magazine, we'd promised to do a lot of heavy-hitting stuff, and we really weren't doing it. And particularly in the corporate field, which I felt really needed a lot of sunlight. So I just started doing it in my spare time. While I was managing the magazine, I started doing it, and I started to enjoy it, did well, won some journalism awards, and just gradually shifted into that part of publishing.
Well, along the way, I mean, you wrote some rather major articles pertaining to the health field. There was the article you wrote on the safety of the Ford Pinto and the deliberate cover-up by Ford that they knew that the gas tanks would explode in a rear-end collision.
That's right.
How did you go about researching a story like that? I'd imagine corporate archives would be closed to most people.
They are, except that there was a safety standard that had been considered in the Department of Transportation that involved rear-end collisions. And I discovered in the files, and that safety standard was vigorously lobbied against by all the automotive companies, particularly Ford. And I discovered in the files, the files open to the public, memoranda that Ford had written to the Department of Transportation arguing against that safety standard. And in those memoranda were cost-benefit analysis that placed a dollar value on human life, admitting that a certain number of people were going to be killed in accidents that involved exploding gas tanks, et cetera, et cetera. And as soon as I found that, I knew I had stuff. And of course, taking that back into the Ford Motor Company, confronting them with it, created wonderful interviews and wonderful responses. So that's where I got it. I actually found that story accidentally through a reconstruction man. These guys reconstruct accidents. And he'd done a reconstruction on an accident.
Well, like for the insurance business to find out how it had happened.
Yeah, and for product liability lawyers, mm-hmm. et cetera. And he'd come to the conclusion, we were just having a beer, and he told me he'd come to the conclusion on an accident that neither driver was at fault in the accident, but that the manufacturer should be culpable because of the design of the gas tank, et cetera. And that led to my investigation.
And the upshot of the article?
Hundreds of millions of dollars in lost liability against the Ford Motor Company. The first homicide trial against an American corporation in Winnemac, Indiana, in a terrible accident involving the death of three young girls. And the ultimate removal of the Pinto from the market. Possibly the ultimate removal of Lee Iacocca from Ford. I don't know exactly why he had to go finally, but they certainly pinned it on him. In the trials that followed my article.
Well, he'd pressured the company, apparently, to turn out a car very quickly.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. The buck stopped right on Iacocca's death on this story. There's no question about it.
You also wrote a major article on the Dalkon Shield and the serious risks to women's health of using that, and that has also been withdrawn from the market and also great expense to the A.H. Robbins Company.
Yes.
And you wrote an article on corporate dumping of products that had been banned in this country but were then sent to marketplaces around the world. That had sort of a less happy ending, if you can call it that.
A less happy ending in that nothing was ever done about it.
Precisely.
Exactly. Well, briefly, there was something done about it. During the Carter administration, Carter issued an executive order outlawing the export of banned and hazardous products from this country. The order lasted for about 3 weeks, because when the Reagan administration came in, one of the first things Reagan did was rescind the order. So we're back where we started. It is still legal in this country to export products that are removed from the market by the regulatory agencies. And it's done.
There's also now kind of an obverse with Europe now deciding to ban American meat that has hormones and steroids and other substances in it. And apparently President Reagan has been having organic meat delivered to him for 3 years?
Absolutely. President Reagan has had a custom butcher in San Fernando Valley of California named Bruce Oxford, who butchers his meat, which is organically grown beef, and he butchers it specially and packages it up, and the Secret Service comes by periodically, picks it up, takes it back to the White House, also delivers it to each of Reagan's children, with the exception of Patty Davis, who's a vegetarian.
And how did you come across this story?
Oh, there's a bunch of obscure little newsletters that I read. This one is a newsletter called Thumper in Southern California, which is a health and diet warning newsletter. And it had just quoted this guy, Bruce Oxford, talking about that he chopped up meat for the president. And so I called him up, and there was a much bigger story there than Thumper thought.
I'm talking with Mark Talley, a journalist who's written articles on all these subjects for Mother Jones magazine and has written a new book about... I guess the harvesting of human organs
is the whole transplant.
The whole transplant business, both the science and the business
of
transplanting. And in part, you acquired this interest in the subject through studies you did of surgery preparatory for your brain surgery. What was the nature of the brain surgery you underwent?
I had a rather obscure tumor in my head called an acoustic neuroma. And the advantage of having an acoustic neuroma, there are two advantages. One, they only grow in one place, and if they return in one place. They don't metastasize like other cancers. The other advantage is that they grow very slowly, so that after you've discovered them, usually you have some time to prepare yourself for the surgery. And I took 2 months and researched the phenomenon itself, the background, the epidemiology, and looked into all the different surgical teams in the country that worked on it. And before I finally chose a team and went in for the surgery. And in the course of doing that, I learned a lot about surgery and the impact of surgery on medicine, the impact that surgery has on medical centers in this country and hospitals, and the role that surgeons are playing in making major medical decisions now. And that all fell into this book as a sort of sideline to my own personal research.
One of the things that I guess that... is common in organ transplant surgery is often the donors don't know that they've given up their organs, because it's a decision that's often made after they're dead. I mean, whether they've indicated beforehand that they want this to happen. And the recipient often has a lot of time to think about it and to go through tests and to prepare and make themselves available to receive this. What did you find goes through somebody's mind while sitting and waiting for the opportunity to get a new organ, a new heart, a new liver?
Well, the waiting lists in this country are very, very long. There are 90,000 people in this country right now who could use a new kidney. There are 15,000 people who die every year who could have been saved with a new heart. These people are very, very desperate people. The numbers for livers are about the same as hearts, incidentally, about 15,000. These are very, very desperate people, and they all... By the time the decision has been made to transplant an organ into them, they've gone pretty much to the end of their disease. They've got a very short time to live, most of them. And, of course, then their families are equally desperate. So there is a tremendous amount of pressure that is created by this desperation that is placed onto the transplant community, and particularly onto the surgeons and the direct health providers in transplantation. It's hard to know what's going on inside an individual mind. I can tell you this, that there's now a psychiatric specialty of transplant psychiatrists who do nothing but treat transplant patients and their families. And the they feel, number one, that the numbers are large enough to justify the specialty, and number two, the situations are unique enough to justify a specialty.
And I imagine some of the issues that come up are guilt at surviving and making use of somebody else's organ who's dead.
Yes.
Depression if it doesn't work or the body begins to reject
guilt the organ. Also at getting it ahead of somebody else on the list.
Uh-huh.
Often somebody right in the same ward, maybe even in the next bed. Guilt amongst families for wishing that their children or their child or would get it ahead of someone else's child. And they'll pass a mother in a parking lot of another child, and they can't look them in the eye because they know that that if one of those kids is going to die, and they hope it's not theirs.
Now, when you say a parking lot, this is because what people camp out in Winnebagoes?
That's right. Yes, yeah. You have read the book. Yes. In Los Angeles, I discovered a family that was waiting, couldn't afford a hotel room or an apartment in Los Angeles. They were from out of town, and they were in a Winnebago in the parking lot of the UCLA hospital waiting for a liver for their little boy. He wasn't quite sick enough to go into the hospital, but he was too sick to stay at home. So he had to, they were living in a Winnebago. And the other family, the mother of the girl who received the liver that I was covering in my book, inadvertently ran into this family living in the Winnebago. And as she explained, she would have been predisposed to help these people out, to bring them food every day and to loan them money. And she was a good Christian, and she would have normally been a Samaritan in this case, but because her child was competing for a liver with the child in the Winnebago, she didn't want to have anything to do with him. And she felt terrible about that. She had to go into therapy herself with a UCLA psychiatrist because of the terrible guilt she felt about feeling this way.
How is the choice made about who gets an organ if there is such a long waiting list and a lack of available organs to donate? What goes in? I know that there was a time when Saudi Arabian princesses had their fathers contribute $500,000 to a medical school so they could get a kidney ahead of the rest of the line. Is that sort of choice still being made?
The whole process of selecting organ recipients is still evolving. But the case that you mentioned, which is a real case, which occurred in Pittsburgh in 1985, really shook up the transplant community in this country very, very hard because it was a scandal. And the articles about it won a Pulitzer Prize. It got a lot of national attention. The federal government investigated it. There was a grand jury investigation, et cetera. I mean, it was a big scandal. To his credit, Dr. Starzl, Tom Starzl, who's that was the head of that unit, who was the indicted party by the press, if you will, in response to the press, initiated a new system of recipient selection that is computerized and involves only medical criteria. So on these large lists of people that are waiting now, everybody is categorized by medical need, medical criteria, length on the list, severity of illness, et cetera. And that, all that information is stuffed into a computer. And the computer, and they're tissue typed and blood typed and all the different medical considerations that have to be made. And the computer coughs out the recipient now. And they instituted that in Pittsburgh in response to the scandal. And I would say well over 50% of the transplant units in the country are now using that or a similar system. They're not all happy about it because doctors like to make decisions on their own.
And I imagine that a doctor also might be an advocate for his or her own patient, too.
Well, doctors, you see, there's this whole philosophy about who owns, philosophical question about who owns a donated organ and at what point it becomes whose property. Obviously, until it's out of the donor owns it even though the donor's dead or the donor's family owns it. But then the minute, most surgeons now feel that once it is allocated to a particular center, that the surgeon in that center owns has the right to decide who gets it and owns the organ. They would never use the word own. They would say, I'm a custodian of it or some euphemism like that. The fact is most of them believe that they should make the decision. And the fact is that a lot of them still make social worth decisions. They will decide that a man who is sick, who has an income and four children, needs this organ more than a young woman who may have turned a bunch of tricks as a prostitute and had a drug problem. on the basis just all other all if all medical criteria are equal, a lot of surgeons will make a decision on the social worth of the patient, and people ethicists believe that has to be stopped, and the way to stop it is with the computer.
I'd like to talk more about the jargon and how that has people thinking about the business of organ transplants. My guest is a journalist, Mark Dowie. He's won awards for his articles on the dangers of the Ford Pinto, the Dalcon Shield, and the dumping of products banned in this country into marketplaces elsewhere in the world. His new book, We Have a Donor, The Bold New Role of Organ Transplanting, describes the transplanting science and business of transplants. His book is published by St. Martin's Press. I'm Sedge Thompson. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Mark Dowie, who's investigated corporations for duplicitous and deadly policies involving knowing bad designs, and his latest research is on the medical, financial, and ethical implications of organ transplants. I struck Mark in reading the book about the jargon that's used, terms such as harvesting or procurement, and debates within the medical community about which use do you use, do you use it in front of the public or not, and also the use of the words biomort and neonort. A neomort, mm-hmm. for those who are brain dead, but whose hearts are still pumping and who are still breathing, and that some transplanting doctors see as the most vivid and most viable source of an organ to transplant. Mm-hmm. Is biomort sort of used up and down the halls of major hospitals?
No, biomorts is used more when lawyers are communicating with doctors on the subject of brain death.
Uh-huh.
The transplanters have to be very, very careful of the terms that they use in the public, particularly terms like harvest, which they use openly amongst themselves. I was at one transplant center, and there was a harvest. There was an harvesting operation going on in the operating room. Outside the operating room, where the family of the donor was standing, on the wall on the bulletin board outside, in big chalk, it said organ harvest. So they looked at the wall, they looked at the door, and that's what they knew was going on inside with their neomort relative. A lot of transplant surgeons begged me not to use the word harvest in my book at all, because they believe that it's a word that triggers a bad response in the public. I told them all that as long as they used it in private, I was going to use it in public. And I've got countless medical journals articles that use the term harvest, and a lot of them still use it openly, although not publicly.
This is a term that also raises issues, particularly in the case of anencephalic infants, children who are born without a brain,
mm-hmm.
But otherwise are physically a functioning being. And transplant doctors, as I recall from your book, see this as a source of hearts, liver,
kidneys,
perhaps even lungs.
Pancreas,
yeah. Skin and bone, perhaps, some.
And immunologically naive tissue. The great thing about young babies and fetal tissue and anencephalics is that their tissue is immunologically naive. It hasn't developed a surface antigen that triggers a rejection response. So a lot of the tissue is useful. Anencephalics are going to be one of the next big issues in transplanting. There has been legislation introduced in California and in New Jersey to define anencephalics and dead as dead, even though in the strictest sense of the brain death statutes in 42 states that have the brain death statutes, they're not dead because their entire brain isn't dead. Only they're missing a cerebral cortex, which is a pretty important part of the brain, but they have an active brain stem, they're breathing on their own, and they don't fit the criteria for brain death. The great fear is that if anencephalics are included and become that the organ transplanters will then turn around and say, see, the brainstem doesn't matter. We've now defined a human being with an active brainstem is dead, so let's just change all the brain death statutes and eliminate the brainstem as a criteria. If you do that, then you open the door to including people in a persistent vegetative state under brain death statutes, so that somebody's PVS could be declared dead and their organs could be harvested.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas right now, they are kept alive because they are by law alive and they're fed. And we have no way of knowing whether they're not in an incredible state of bliss that we shouldn't interrupt by terminating their lives.
What goes on out in the hallway where a family has to be told that their loved one is a hopeless case, is not going to live or would not, you know, has had this damage? Could they, by the way, consider donating organs so that somebody else could use them?
The ritual of request.
The ritual of request.
Is what they call it, the ritual of request. And that's a ritual that has evolved over the last 25 years since organ transplanting started and since brain death laws were instituted. And it's become an almost formal ritual now. It's required in most hospitals that anybody who is dying that could potentially be an organ donor, their family must be asked, or must, in some states, they must only be informed of their option to donate organs. In other states, they have to actually be asked to donate. Now the federal government requires anybody receiving Medicare money to institute a request protocol in their hospital asking for organs and tissues of people who are dying. So what that has done is create a rather conflicting role for nurses, psychiatric nurses, and social workers in hospitals whose jobs originally were to help the grieving and suffering people of dying patients, who now, because of the requirements of organ transplanting, have got to start asking for organs before people are declared dead.
You found a relationship about race and who donates organs, and that 90% of the black people who receive organs, those organs have come from white people, yet the ratio is almost reversed the other way around, and the black people feel that they don't want their organs going to white people.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on here, and is this changing, and how can it change?
If it's changing, it's not changing noticeably. One of the most ardent campaigners for organ donation is a black organ transplant surgeon named Clive Callender. He speaks all the time in the black community, trying to convince black people that it's to their benefit to donate organs and to donate the organs of their loved ones. The black community, the polls that have been done of black people regarding organ donation seem to indicate that blacks feel that their organs are going to go to white people. And Callender is trying to convince them that that isn't true. Callender practices at Howard University.
Because amongst black people, I mean, kidney disease and circulatory problems are
higher than whites.
Higher than whites.
And the black people need, there's more of a demand among black people per capita for new kidneys than there are amongst white people.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that if blacks donated organs, they would almost always go to black people because of the enormous demand. And so you're right. The ratio really should be reversed. And I think a calendar is starting to get some effect, at least in the eastern part of the country.
You've spent a lot of time investigating nefarious doings by organizations. The business of procuring parts such as cadavers and so on for medical research, like from the time of Burke and Hare and probably before, has always been, you know, filled with tales of skullduggery and nasty doings in the middle of night and robbing graveyards and so on. A lot of the transplanting business, most of it is certainly above board and so on now. But what kind of skullduggery have you come across?
Well, in terms of what the medical profession calls the solid organs, the kidney, liver, heart, pancreas, and the major organs of the body, there are not really any major overt scandals that I know of, and I don't think there ever really have been. There's been some cases questioning whether or not people should have been harvested at certain times. Most of those cases predate brain death legislation, but that's not where the scandal is in this business. The scandal is in the tissue side of the business, which are the less vital parts of the body that are harvested after the vital organs are harvested, the bone, the skin, the dura mater, the connective tissues, ligaments, that sort of thing. The industry that does that is a very aggressive industry. There have been a lot of scandals in that industry, which I don't play up in my book because I didn't want my book to be a scandal book. But one broke recently in Southern California where they discovered a contract crematorium that was doing cremations for a whole chain of funeral homes down there that were harvesting the bones of people before they cremated them without permission, and were cremating them en masse and shipping, you know, a mixture of ashes back to the funeral homes. It was a huge scandal. There's been several like that, and I think that if any part of the transplant community has got to reform itself, it's that part. It's the tissue banking thing. Tissue banking also is quasi-private, privatized, and it shouldn't be.
Is part of this because tissue banking, the tissues that are saved can last longer than the solid organs?
Oh, absolutely. You've got to get solid organs into the under the recipient's body within, anywhere from 4 to 24 hours.
So you have this...
Or it just decays. Hmm?
So you have this incredibly complex yet efficient system of jets and helicopters,
yes,
and phone beepers,
right,
to keep people in touch with one another and get,
right,
the organs across.
The guy in my book,
uh-huh,
who is the donor at the beginning of my book, he, within 24 hours after he died, his parts were in 32 different people in the country, corneas, his organs, body parts, et cetera. It's a very, very fast business, and it's amazing in that respect. It's very dramatic in that respect. The tissue banking part of it doesn't have to move that fast because you can store bone, freeze it, store it almost indefinitely. Same with skin and other less non-cellular parts of the body. As a result, you have a banking business on the side and of the business. And there's some question about the ethical efficacy of that business.
I've been struck by the sort of the high profile that some of the hospitals in Tennessee and Southern California achieve with their transplants, the baby Jesse, the baby Billy, the baby this, and,
mm-hmm,
you know, the great sort of media play that's made, that almost seems in a way to pervert the good aspects of a transplantation in that these are seem ploys designed to benefit the publicity department of the hospital more than the actual child involved.
Transplanters, and by that I include not only the surgeons but also the nurses and the transplant coordinators and everybody that fall under the rubric of the transplant community, have very mixed feelings about media coverage of their specialty. They know that there has to be public consciousness because that's how you get organ donor drives going. And they there's nothing better than a nice heroic transplant story to keep a hospital on the front page of the newspaper for a while. On the other hand, the media darling aspect, which is what the media tends to respond to with the darling little children who only have a few minutes to live, is not really good because usually the media darling gets the organ because they've been in the media, not because they medically deserve it or need it more. And as a result, a tremendous amount of resentment starts to build up, not only in the transplant community, but amongst the people who are waiting for organs and the people who are supporting the transplant community and the public, et cetera. So it's a mixed blessing, all this media attention. And of course, it's a mixed blessing also because it's blown organ transplanting way out of proportion. And it has made us think of organ transplants when we look in a hospital, when really it's a minor thing that's going on if you look at the whole operation of a hospital. And it's organ transplanting's impact on medicine has been inordinate largely because of the publicity that it's received. So it's a damn if you do, damn if you don't situation. They need it to keep the organ donations coming in, but they really don't need it because of the impact that it has on some other aspects of medicine.
Do you have a donor card in your wallet?
Yes, I do. It stipulates that my heart must go to a baboon.
Mark Dowie's book on the world of organ transplants is called We Have a Donor. It's published by St. Martin's Press. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with the chief executive officer of Barfco Swill Merchandising and Barking Pumpkin Records. You may know him as a musician. My guest will be Frank Zappa. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. Poet and critic Robert Haas sees a large part of what he does as cleaning the windows of perception, bringing a transcendental vision to ordinary images and events. Coming up, a talk with Robert Haas. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews About Yesterday's Aesthetics, the latest album from Franz Kogelman and his quintet. And television critic David Bien Cooley examines whether the two latest challengers can dethrone Johnny Carson as king of the late-night talk show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Across the country and around the world today, Americans honored the memory of the man whose dream of peace and civil justice helped move the nation toward the path of racial equality. To mark the 60th birthday of murdered civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., the Liberty Bell rang in Philadelphia. National leaders joined King's family in Atlanta. And in Pretoria, South Africa, U.S. Ambassador Edward Perkins marked the holiday by unveiling a bronze bust of King that will sit in a new American embassy compound. In Washington, President-elect George Bush praised the fallen leader at a prayer breakfast commemorating King's birth. Details from NPR's Phyllis Crockett.
Many of those at the breakfast have been critical of civil rights policies under the Reagan administration. They say they expect things to be better under George Bush. They give him credit for working behind the scenes a few years ago to help get the legislation passed that created the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Today, Bush said that King should be remembered and honored by all Americans.
He lived a hero's life. He dreamed a hero's dreams. And he left a hero's indelible mark on the mind and imagination of a great nation.
Bush said as president, fulfilling King's dream would be his mission, although he did not outline specifics about how he would do that. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
A West German official admitted today that Bonn has known for months that West German firms were implicated in the construction of a chemical plant in Libya. For the first time, Bonn has publicly agreed with U.S. claims that the plant is capable of producing chemical weapons. Deidre Berger has details.
Bonn was informed last August by its Secret Service that West German firms were probably involved in building a factory for chemical weapons in Libya, according to Finance Minister Gerhard Stoltenberg. Spiegel magazine today claims the intelligence operation goes back as far as 1986. Stoltenberg says no government inquiry was launched in August because the intelligence agency was afraid its ongoing investigation would be damaged. The finance minister also said the information was too vague to justify criminal investigation. After weeks of press reports implicating Imhausen Chemical Company and other West German firms, several Bonn officials now say that West German firms were involved in the plant construction. A criminal investigation of Imhausen was launched last week, but Minister Stoltenberg says it is still not clear if West German firms broke export laws. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
Foreign ministers from 34 nations have begun arriving in Vienna, where they'll sign a disarmament and human rights accord that's being hailed as a breakthrough in East-West relations. The first to arrive was George Shultz on his last foreign trip as Secretary of State. The ministers will endorse a new set of talks due to start in March on reducing conventional force levels in Europe and a package of proposals on improving human rights and economic cooperation in Europe. Czechoslovak police attacked demonstrators in Prague today with tear gas and water cannon in the second day of protests aimed at bringing social and political reform to the country. About 14 people were arrested. Yesterday, hundreds of police broke up a protest by more than 4,000 people in Prague. The Soviet deputy defense minister says Moscow will begin its unilateral troop withdrawal from Eastern Europe in April. Vitaly Shavanov told Austrian television today that the first phase of the partial pullout will be completed this year, and the second in 1990. Some 50,000 Soviet troops are deployed in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and East Germany. The Soviet Union said today its grain harvest last year was the worst in 3 years, affirming fears expressed by Kremlin leader Mikhail Gorbachev that food production has bogged down. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street, the Dow Industrial Average off nearly 2 points. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Austrian flugelhorn player Franz Kogelmann has been recording since the mid-70s. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says his records always feature an interesting mix of American and European jazz musicians and musical influences. Kevin also says Kogelmann's music can sometimes be gloomy, but a sense of humor surfaces on his latest album.
Musicians who play the standard repertoire of classic jazz and pop songs face a constant challenge to keep their music fresh, to keep from playing the same old pieces in the same old ways. One musician who takes that challenge to heart is the Austrian composer and flugelhorn player Franz Kogelmann, whose latest album is called About Yesterday's Aesthetics, a CD on the Hat Art label. It features durable old tunes arranged by Kogelmann and members of his quintet. Kogelmann fits improvising into complex structures. He claims the influence of West Coast cool jazz and of the lyrical chamber music of Vienna's Alban Berg. He's always had a feel for bright ensemble colors. This time out, his band swings more than usual, too. Here's Franz Kogelmann's quintet on George Russell's composition, Aesthetic. Steve Lacy plays soprano sax. That's flugelhornist Franz Kogelmann with Mario Arcari on oboe and Klaus Koch on bass. In most jazz performances, the band plays the theme and then the soloists improvise variations. But Kogelmann's quintet may play the solos first and the melody second. That way, the written part seems to arise out of the improvisation instead of the other way around. Sometimes, her approach is more oblique. Drummer Fritz Hauser conceived a radical version of Dizzy Gillespie's A Night in Tunisia. Here's how Gillespie played it in 1946. But in the Kogelmann Quintet version, which is heavy on collective improvisation, the melody of Night in Tunisia becomes a minor element in a sort of musical landscape painting, an impressionistic portrait of North Africa after dark. In drummer Fritz Hauser's arrangement of the Sonny Rollins calypso St. Thomas, it takes the horns over a minute just to state the tune's 8-bar theme. On this album, Hauser limits his kit to snare drum, hi-hat, and cymbals. Elsewhere, Kogelman plays two tunes at once to highlight their similar chord progressions. Irving Berlin's They Say It's Wonderful is heard on oboe, and Harold Arlen's Over the Rainbow is played on the bass. The strategies that Kogelman and company use aren't really new. Other musicians have inverted the order of theme and solos, and Charles Mingus was superimposing different melodies with the same chords in the 1950s. Kogelman reminds us that jazz musicians don't really need new strategies for playing standards. They just need to remember the strategies that are already here.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed About Yesterday's Aesthetics. That's Aesthetics spelled E-double-Z-T-H-E-T-I-C-S. It's Franz Kogelman's new album on the Hat Art label. This is Fresh Air. Like most children growing up in the 40s and 50s, poet Robert Hass learned to read through the activities of Dick and Jane. But when Dick and Jane took fall walks to look at the trees changing colors or put on their boots to go out and play in the snow, he knew those images didn't reflect his California childhood. Much of Hass's poetry draws upon the California landscape he knows and hikes in. His first book, Field Guide, won the Yale Series of Young Poets Award in 1973. Hass has also translated the poems of Czesław Miłosz and won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism in 1984 for his essays and reviews. I ask him to read from his upcoming book of poems, Human Wishes.
The young composer, working that summer at an artist's colony, had watched her for a week. She was Japanese, a painter, almost 60, and he thought he was in love with her. He loved her work, and her work was like the way she moved her body, used her hands, looked at him directly when she made amused and considered answers to his questions. One night, walking back from a concert, they came to her door, and she turned to him and said, "I think you would like to have me." "I would like that too, but I must tell you that I've had a double mastectomy." And when he didn't understand, "I've lost both my breasts." The radiance that he had carried around in his belly and chest cavity, like music, withered very quickly, and he made himself look at her when he said, "I'm sorry, I don't think I could." He walked back to his own cabin through the pines, and in the morning he found a small blue bowl on the porch outside his door. It looked to be full of rose petals, but he found, when he picked it up, that the rose petals were on top. The rest of the bowl, she must have swept them from the corner of her studio, was full of dead bees.
What was your source for this story?
It was a story that was told to me, and I don't any longer remember which part of it was told to me and which part of it was invented.
Well, and that's how you've made it something of your own now.
I suppose. Wordsworth has a phrase about the world. He said, "The world, both what we half perceive and half create," I suppose. And I suppose that's what images are, too.
You've said that images haunt.
Mm-hmm. I think that images fix our desires before we can articulate what they are very often. Things we want, things we feel we've lost. And I think that's why they haunt us. They're imagined completions of feelings of incompleteness.
One of the things that struck me about your poetry most is the vividness of the imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you once said that you wrote about the writing of beach towels drying on a fence at the end of August in the early morning heat, and you were pleased about your description of it. Yet you admitted that if you were in the 17th century Japan and you went to a poetry master who might have told you, "Hass, you have the weakness of trying to say something unusual." I mean, isn't that what poets do, try to say something unusual and vivid?
Well, it's very, yes. I mean, it's very interesting in the reading the Masters of Haiku and this whole tradition of the image. In the story that you are remembering, the line that I had written or thought about writing, I saw the beach towels on the fence. I thought if I could just say those images, I could convey what the end of summer was as an experience at the core of one's being. And theoretically, you ought to be able to say that plainly by just saying, as in a haiku, late August, beach towels drying on the fence or something like that. When I said it, when I wrote the lines, they seemed flat to me. I thought, how could I improve them? And it's probably that it's the second thought that's the too clever or the not quite right. And I thought that evening, I thought, seeing them again, ah, that's it, beach towels drying in the moonlight. I thought I'd settled the problem. In the morning, I woke up and knew that Basho would have disapproved, that the whole tradition of haiku was intensely focused on simplicity and ordinariness.
Are you ever overwhelmed by images?
Sure. Aren't you?
The times when I'm overwhelmed most with images are when I'm in some place new that I've not been before, or it's a time of day that I've not experienced in mm-hmm. a place. Mm-hmm. And then I feel myself overloaded with colors and lights mm-hmm. and sounds and smells. But there is, I think, that sort of form of survival of being able to shut out what you are around otherwise every day.
Yeah. A Russian formalist critic early in the century named Viktor Sklovsky, I think was his name, said about art, he said, the function of art is to make the stone stone and the grass grass and to free us from the automatism of perception. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a kind of practical biological theory of art, that it's necessarily the nature of human perception that it's habitual, that we take a thing in and put it aside once we've mastered it, that makes us increasingly dead to our common experience. And so art emerges, or one kind of art, this kind of art that we're talking about, ecstatic art, has another function, I think. But this kind of art has, as I think it was Ezra Pound said, function of cleaning the windows of perception. And I think it's based on that physiological and psychological reality and need that in order not to be dead to our lives, some of us have to do the work of trying to keep it fresh.
Let me quickly bring you back to something here at home, a detail of memory of your life. Mm-hmm. You were growing up, and your father would send you to bed at about 9:15 at night, mm-hmm. and you and your brother would be in bed at night, and you'd turn on the radio secretly and listen to I Love a Mystery. And your father would be downstairs working on a book or a project, uh-huh. and you would know that you would be secretly listening to the radio, but somehow your father knew that you would be secretly listening. And you say this taught you an attitude toward truth that you're still trying to unlearn. What is that attitude?
Oh, I think for my father, what he wanted to be true was true. Our life was constructed around certain imaginative fictions of his. And in the way that you do with people that you love, I think I got into the habit of not contradicting him when I knew, because I didn't want to hurt his feelings or get into an argument with him, when I thought that what he was saying or describing was inaccurate. He loved to tell stories about his children. The stories all had to do with the characters that he had given us. And I've noticed in myself both a tendency to do the same thing, to tell the interesting version rather than the accurate version of the story, and also to assume that other people are doing the same thing.
So when you're writing a poem and working with the images, this is then a constant struggle for you to use the more interesting image or the more accurate one.
Yeah, often it comes around questions of sound even. You know, I remember in an early poem, when I wrote these lines, I had written, the otters are gone from the bay and I have seen 5 horses, easy in the grassy marsh beside 3 snowy egrets. Well, I was unhappy with snowy egret, and I thought 2 E sounds were very unfortunate. And I had even remembered that Tennyson had thought it was a particular flaw in some poet or other that they had run E sounds against one another. So I was
Well, you're up against the actual name of the bird there, too.
There I had the actual name of the bird. And as a kind of afterthought, I don't know what I was thinking of, except poets get hypnotized by sound, I started playing with substitutions and put in crane at one point. Now, this is terrible in several ways. One of which is that, as far as I know, there's no white crane. The nearest thing around here is the sandhill crane, which is far from white. It's done. But it sounded, I thought it sounded better. And when I was going over this book with the older poet, master poet, Stanley Kunitz, I paused on this line and I said, I have a dilemma here because I really... I have seen five horses easy in the grassy marsh beside three snowy cranes. Sounded wonderful, but in fact, of course, it were egrets. And he sniffed and said, I prefer egrets to any kind of crane. And I think that was the last time I strayed toward Victorian tuneful inaccuracy.
Robert Haas, thank you very much for stopping in on Fresh Air today.
Thank you, Sedge. It was a pleasure.
Poet Robert Haas, who's edited a new collection of poems, Rock and Hawk, by California poet Robinson Jeffers. This is Fresh Air. Stay tuned for All Things Considered, coming up later from National Public Radio. Alex Chadwick had to rush back up to the studio, so I'll tell you what's on the show today. To mark the birthday of Martin Luther King, today's edition of All Things Considered looks at racism against blacks in America with writer John Langston Gwaltney. In his book, Dry Long So, Gwaltney has captured the voices of black Americans, reflecting on the racism they've confronted through their lives. Also, President-elect Bush marks Dr. King's birthday with a speech to a group of black Republicans, and the planning for this week's big inaugural festivities continues. All that and more on All Things Considered, coming up later on National Public Radio. If you're a fan of late-night talk shows, you've probably noticed that when you roam the channels, there's been more to choose from over the past couple of weeks. Television critic David Bianculli assesses the two men who are challenging he who's lasted longest.
Here's Johnny!
You sound in a good mood tonight. Are you? Be honest. Are you, No. Are you here to see me or to take notes for your own talk show?
It's easy to see why Johnny Carson is a little paranoid. That was from his first show after coming back from vacation. And while he was gone, Arsenio Hall and Pat Sajak each started their own late-night talk shows. Now, at this point, I gotta tell you, I'm a little talked out. My idea of a talk show is to have a guest who has something to say and a host who knows how to ask questions and to listen. My idea of an entertaining talk show isn't The Tonight Show. It's Bill Moyers interviewing Joseph Campbell. But here I am on what might be called a talk show, talking about a talk show host who's talking about other talk shows. It's a hall of mirrors, and mirrors are a lot more entertaining to watch than some of the so-called talk shows out there. At least Arsenio Hall and Pat Sajak act like natural hosts, and as the talk show territory is carved up, each of them has a shot at a different piece of the pie. Carson is the king of late night, and that's not going to change. Meanwhile, David Letterman's wonderful style of interviewing isn't so much to welcome people, but to annoy them. What's left for the new kids on the block? Well, Arsenio Hall seems to be adopting the old Dick Cavett-style name-dropping routine, while at the same time maintaining a very hyper-energy level. On the premiere show, Hall and Brooke Shields managed to drop more names per second than anyone this side of SCTV's satirical Bobby Bittman show.
That club, remember, 2020?
Is that when I ripped all your clothes off and attacked you?
Yes, but before that.
Oh.
No, because you were with Cornelia Guest, and you all were dancing, and I was with Eddie and Rob Lowe, and Rob Lowe was like, oh, dude, look at her, man, I gotta have her, you know, and I'm like, chill, Rob, chill. You know?
Pat Sajak, on the other hand, is surprisingly non-irritating. He makes fun of the talk show conventions without straying from them too far. He's very fast with ad-libs, and he doesn't feel the necessity to throw in a punchline every 15 seconds. This makes him automatically better than David Brenner and Joan Rivers, just to name two recent failures in the late-night talk show arena. When you get right down to it, the difference between Sajak and Letterman is that when Letterman hosts his talk show, you get the feeling he's almost doing it at gunpoint. Sajak, even though he doesn't take it any more seriously, looks like he's having more fun, and that could be contagious. What I like the most are his little field trips away from the studio. This is stolen straight from Letterman, who stole it from Steve Allen, but notice Sajak's difference in tone. Letterman's field trips are designed to make us laugh at people. With Sajak, as in this visit to his personal physician, it's Sajak himself who provides the humor.
Hi, Patrick.
Collinsworth, hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. Don't mind the cameras here. It's just my new show, Celebrity Malpractice.
So thanks so much, Patrick. Good seeing you.
Blood pressure,
yeah,
eh?
Yeah, blood pressure.
Velcro?
Velcro.
Oh, that's good. That's better than the carpet tacks you used last time.
In terms of style, Sajak is closest to Jay Leno, the droll substitute host of The Tonight Show. If and when Carson retires, and if and when Leno becomes the new Tonight Show host, he and Sajak will be going head-to-head in the most interesting talk show battle since Carson versus Cabot. But right now, after all this talk, I don't even want to talk about it.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post.
Ladies and gentlemen, Pat Sajak.
Very well trained. Thank you very much. Boy, now that I've got you all here, I'd like to talk to you about something called Herbalife, if I may.
Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. When sculptor David Ireland started renovating an old home in San Francisco's Mission District, he needed a place to live. But then he discovered the 18 worn-out brooms and the piles of rubber bands, and he started seeing what he calls the social system of the home played out over 100 years. On our next show, David Ireland talks about preserving the art of everyday acts. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles pub rock, a precursor to the punk movement. And book critic John Leonard reviews the novel Waverly Place. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Tim Jacoby. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.